Good afternoon, fine listeners. You are listening to CKUW 95.9 FM. I'm Scott Price. This is Radio Free World. On July 25th, I talked with Jordan Flaherty. He's a journalist and staffer with the Louisiana Justice Institute. He is an award-winning reporter from the Gulf Coast, and he has been featured in a range of outlets, including the New York Times and Al Jazeera. He is the author of Flood Lines, Community and Resistance from Katrina to Jenna 6. Flood Lines is a firsthand account of community, culture, and resistance in New Orleans in the years before and after Katrina. I talked with Jordan Flaherty about the ongoing case against New Orleans police after Hurricane Katrina, the senseless murdering of innocent civilians, as well as the cover-up by local police and the media in New Orleans following this. All right, Jordan. So I think where we should begin here with the interview is kind of give the backstory to this, the case involving murder and police corruption within the New Orleans police force. So just kind of give the backdrop to Hurricane Katrina and what happened.
Absolutely. So in the days after Hurricane Katrina, at first I think people around the country and around the world really felt sympathy for the people of New Orleans. They saw those images of people trapped on rooftops and trapped at the convention center and Superdome. But then media coverage shifted, and you suddenly had people from New Orleans being called criminals and looters and thugs, and our governor at the time, Kathleen Blanco, said, "I'm sending in National Guard troops. They're locked and loaded. They've been trained to shoot to kill, and I expect they will." The second in charge of our police department told a gathering of officers that they were to go out and they could shoot looters. He said, "We're taking our city back." He said, if you can sleep with it at night, you can do it." And so, you know, you suddenly had this extreme criminalization and demonization of the survivors of Hurricane Katrina. And in the days after that, you had several incidents of police violence. You had an African-American man in the West Bank neighborhood of New Orleans, Henry Glover, who was shot by one officer, and other officers beat up people that tried to rescue him and then burned Henry Glover's body and left it burned in a car by the levees. You had another man who was shot right outside of the convention center by officers when he tried to wave down a police car and demand help. And perhaps the most shocking incident happened on the Danziger Bridge, which is a bridge from the New Orleans East neighborhood into the Gentilly neighborhood of New Orleans. And several African-American civilians were fleeing their flooded homes, trying to get to dry land, crossing this bridge. And a group of officers came on them and basically decided, because they were black and still in the city at this time, that they were suspect, and they began firing indiscriminately at these unarmed civilians. Two of them were killed, four were wounded. Ronald Madison, a mentally challenged man with a mental capacity of an 8-year-old, was shot in the back by one officer. Another officer ran up and stomped on him and kicked him until he was dead. James Brissett, a nerdy, as his friends described him, 17-year-old, was shot to death by officers. Jose Holmes Jr., I believe he was 17 years old at the time, was shot several times by officers, including one officer who stood above him and shot him point blank in the stomach while he was lying on the ground bleeding. Susan Bartholomew, a 38-year-old mother, was shot several times by officers. Her daughter, Lisa Bartholomew, 17 years old, was crawling on top of her mother trying to shield her body with her own, and she was shot several times. Susan Bartholomew had her arm shot off of her body. So you had this incredible bloodshed that happened, and officers immediately saw in the aftermath of this that even in this atmosphere, when they'd been told that anything goes, that this might look bad. And according to prosecutors, it was at this moment that the cover-up began. And you had this cover-up that involved secret meetings. This is according to prosecutors and according to the witness stories, including officers who have since pled guilty in exchange for lesser charges. You had secret meetings. You had weapons that were planted. You had witnesses that were invented. You had officers writing and rewriting and telling and retelling their versions of the story until it sounded more believable and until they sounded more innocent. And, you know, this cover-up went on for several years, And basically every single check and balance that we have in our city failed us. The district attorney refused to investigate. The U.S. attorney refused to investigate. And that's not the immediate district attorney after Hurricane Katrina, but the next district attorney, Leon Cannizzaro. You had the media, for the most part, was not investigating these stories of police violence. You had a coroner who was going along with the official police story. So all these checks and balances our system should have really failed us. And it was only because of grassroots activists, especially the family members of those who had been killed, that these stories eventually came out and that now we're seeing these trials and these prosecutions of these officers that committed these crimes.
I was following the story with your blog posts, but I mean, hearing you retell this and the wide berth of this is, it's beyond shocking, really. I mean, it's I'm almost speechless. When you started listing all the victims, but. You talk about the systematic repression of this story. Talk more about that and sort of the details and intricacies of this cover-up as far as, you mentioned the police, the coroner, the media, just as some that I remember in my head now. Talk about more of the details of that, please.
Well, you're absolutely right to be shocked by the story. It is incredibly shocking, and just the shocking details of the story are enough that I think would make it something important to be looked at. But you're also absolutely right that it's the larger systemic issues that it raises that really raises the questions of makes it an even more important story. So, for example, just within the department, the fact that you had, high up people in the department that were helping with this cover-up. And that were
you're talking about the police department, right?
Yeah,
the police department.
New Orleans Police Department.
Okay.
And in fact, even that second in charge of police department, who later became the chief of police, he admitted that he never even read the report of what happened in this incident on the bridge. It goes up to the top of the department. And in fact, right now, the situation that we're seeing in the police department is the current chief of police, there's been calls for investigation of him because he's been closely linked to people that have been involved in this profiteering scandal. The second in charge of the department was just forced to retire because he was shown to be basically part of that cover-up of the Henry Glover killing that I mentioned earlier. The third in charge of the department, there's 16 people at the rank of commander, which is third in charge. Of those 16, four of them are currently under investigation for several charges, including one of them for giving directions to officers to basically go out and harass young black men. So, this is definitely the investigations that branch out from these police violence investigations go to the very top of the department. And then, as you mentioned, the other systems that intersect with this. So the coroner's office has been shown to always go along with these police version of events. For example, on the Henry Glover incident, that body found burned by the levee was never flagged as a potential homicide by the coroner's office. If you look at another recent police violence trial that has come up because of these activists pressuring for this, Raymond Robert was a man who was found badly beaten by officers. In fact, he was beaten to death. He had broken ribs. He had his spleen was burst. Bruises all over his body. The coroner said that was consistent with him just having tripped and fallen, that the police had nothing to do with it. He tripped and fell on the sidewalk, and that's where his injuries probably came from. So, the coroner, in fact, PBS, our national public broadcaster, just had an investigation of the coroner that they had on TV several months ago. The local paper has been calling for his resignation. The media, for several years, really was not telling the story of police violence after Hurricane Katrina. William Tanner, who was beaten by police, he was one of the last people to see Henry Glover alive. He said that, he tried to tell the media this story and they laughed him out of the room. It took, in fact, a journalist named A.C. Thompson, who had no connection to the city, to finally tell the story of Henry Glover that our local media failed to tell. He came and did what the rest of our media failed to do and spent 16 months investigating the story, and he published it in late 2008. And that really gave an extra ammunition to activists that were trying to fight this struggle and to bring the story to light. And they used the occasion of A.C. Thompson's story come out to continue to pressure on the Justice Department. The fact that we had a new Justice Department in the Obama administration under Eric Holder, there was more interest in these investigations, helped. And so finally in 2009, almost 4 years after Hurricane Katrina, these investigations that sort of happened right after the storm finally began.
Hmm. Now, turning to the media's role in this, in other posts you kind of touched upon how the media is sort of, what's the word they use, embedded with the police, in a sense, kind of how they say, you know, during the war in Iraq, you know, we're embedded with the troops. And that essentially means that, as far as I can discern, is that they usually take the line. If it's in the military case, they take the line with the military. In this case, they just take the line with the police officers, right? So that was a similar thing that was going on here, that essentially the media was embedded with the New Orleans Police Department?
Well, you know, there's definitely complications to it. There's good reporters and bad reporters, and there's several reporters that I think were trying to do their best. But I think that there's systemic problems with our media in the U.S. and including in New Orleans. You know, historically, our daily paper, the Times-Picayune, has, you know, underreported issues around police violence. You know, and the New Orleans Times-Picayune, like most newspapers in the U.S., didn't have any black reporters for much of the 20th century, just as the New Orleans Police Department had no black police officers through much of the 20th century. And so I think when you have an institution that comes out of that, the stories specifically from the African-American community often get ignored because they don't have the roots in those communities. Now, what we had historically in New Orleans was a very strong African-American media. The Louisiana Weekly is one newspaper that did cover these stories. But in the sort of crisis of media that we're facing in this country, where there's a lack of funding for media and people now with the internet expect their media for free and people don't pay for their newspapers regularly, all of that, that has meant really a collapse of the black medium, so a collapse of any alternative in New Orleans that would maybe be putting pressure on the more corporate media or the more mainstream media. And so that, you know, it's really been a systemic problem, but there's certainly places where you can point where it's more than just a system, it is individual at fault. So, for example, there was a reporter named Alex Brandon, who was a photographer for the Times-Picayune during the time of Hurricane Katrina, and later went to work for Associated Press. And Alex Brandon was very close to police officers, and he was actually there at the Henry Glover incident when officers were beating the people that had tried to rescue Henry Glover, when other officers took Henry Glover's body away to light it on fire. And Alex Brandon picked up his camera as if he was about to take a picture, and one of the officers told him not to take a picture, and he didn't. And even more than that, an agent from a federal agency, I believe it was DEA, was nearby. And he took a picture, and Alex Brandon actually said to the agent, "Oh, the police said not to take pictures." And the federal agent said to him, "Well, I don't work for them." Hmm. Which I think, you know, really shows how much it appeared that this Alex Brandon person did work for them. And in fact, more than that, even in the following months, Alex Brandon never told his editors about this incident, never spoke up about it. And so, you know, you have examples like that of reporters that are too close and that stayed silent. But I think larger than that, you have these systemic issues of a media that is not based in the communities that are dealing with these issues, and so they haven't historically done as good a job of telling these stories in these communities.
Right. Now, as I understand it, there are, as you mentioned, there are some of these people who have been implicated, who are in court now. Tell us a bit about the court case and how it is proceeding.
Well, you know, it's it's very hard to convict officers in this country. You know, I think there's a feeling among many people in the U.S. that officers, you know, they're given this gun, they're given the authority to enforce the laws, and even when there's a lot of evidence of officers killing people inappropriately, you know, I think that there's, it's very difficult to convict. But this is a really exceptional case. I mean, I described some of the details of it. Beyond that, you have five officers that have already pled guilty in exchange for lesser charges. So we've been hearing from other officers who talked about how these officers came out. They did not identify themselves as officers. They didn't wait to see if they saw any weapons. They immediately started shooting. And they continued shooting. And they even when people were bleeding and on the ground and clearly unarmed, they continued shooting and firing point blank at people. And then in the aftermath of that, they went and immediately launched this cover-up. And you had officers testifying about the cover-up. You've also had this incredibly moving testimony from the survivors that were there on the bridge, from Leisha Bartholomew, that teenager who tried to shield her mother with her body, from Susan Bartholomew herself, whose arm has been shot off, and you know, you could see her there on the stand with her missing arm, and from Jose Holmes, who was this sweet young kid who was shot by officers, and describing his friend James Brissett as nerdy, who was killed by officers. So hearing this testimony, I think, has been incredibly powerful. You know, we don't know what this jury will think and what they'll decide. There's one African-American on the jury. Most of the jury is not from New Orleans. They're from the suburbs around New Orleans. And so, you know, I think that there's definitely a question about how they will decide on all of this. But it is definitely an exceptional case to have this kind of testimony, to have a jury hear this kind of testimony.
Mm-hmm. Now, quickly, just to wrap up, I mean, with a case like this, it shows, like you said, like such systemic problems with corruption and racism. Do you feel that, at the very least, that this brought some of these problems more to the forefront of people, or you know, in people's minds, or are people still, you know, remaining kind of blind to all this happening in New Orleans? I'm talking more about specifically in Louisiana, but I mean, we could also talk more generally about across the United States.
This has absolutely changed the narrative of Hurricane Katrina. For years, these stories were silenced, and I think the dominant narrative was these stories of looters, of criminals, of thugs, and now we're seeing this story that, as former District Attorney Eddie Jordan said, the police were responsible for more violent crime than any of the citizens of New Orleans. And absolutely in New Orleans, there's huge call for reform and for systemic change in this department. It's likely there will be some form of federal oversight in the department where they will have changing across the board from hiring to training to discipline. You've already had some of these changes start to take effect with the new police chief, and you have more pressure for change. We have the largest per capita city jail in the U.S., and there's pressure to shrink the jail, and there's been successes on that. And I really want to stress that whatever victories come out of this, it's not because the Justice Department came in or because Obama had a better attorney general than the Bush administration. These things are all factors, but what really made this happen is grassroots activists that fought for years and struggled against the wall of official silence to get these stories out. And that, ultimately, I think, is the most important reason why this story needs to be told. People, I think, too often feel helpless and feel like they can't change a situation, they can't fight against these kind of incidents of police violence or official corruption. And this story of New Orleans in the past years shows how a small group of dedicated people fought and struggled on many fronts, whether it was a media strategy, they had demonstrations, they pushed on the city council, they pushed on the state legislature, they pushed on Congress people, they were organizing, they were going door to door, knocking on doors, building an organization in the communities most affected. And this struggle worked, and we're now seeing major changes system-wide in our criminal justice system and the prison industrial complex of New Orleans. And it's because of these people that fought and struggled in a really strategic, smart, and accountable way for several years.
Hmm. Well, thank you very much for your time, Jordan. This is, I mean, it's fascinating. It's probably one of the most, well, I don't even, I mean, shocking. There's so many words to describe this. But thank you so much for giving your time, as well as your effort in documenting everything that's going on with this case. And I hope to maybe talk to you soon or another time in the future about all this again.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate it, and I appreciate the work that you all do at the radio station to get these stories out and so many other important stories. So thank you so much.
If you want to read more of the ongoing case in New Orleans and this ongoing tale of police murder and corruption, you can check out floodlines.org, which is the website for Jordan's book, which documents community and resistance from Katrina to Jenna 6. As well, you can check out Jordan posts regularly for the Real News Network on their blogs. So check both those out. For Radio Free World, I'm Scott Price.